all know Dr. Cook's credentials. He did his master's public health at Harvard, and he's currently very involved with both research and teaching as an instructor at the Harvard Medical School and the director of research at Mount Auburn Hospital in Cambridge. Dr. Cook.
Actually, I was threatened if I actually got one. So, we're just going to briefly talk about falls prevention here. Obviously, I have no disclosures related to falls prevention. So, I'm going to start off by telling you about this friend of mine. Her name's Etta Munson. She's a 91-year-old woman. She's got a horrible past medical history. She's got a missing kidney from birth, polio, spinal meningitis, lung, liver, pancreatic cancer, diabetes, cardiomyopathy, cystic acne, and of course, worst of all, she's got an increased fall risk. This is a patient who's had many issues. She's ended up showing up in my clinic last year with a report of a single fall, and then a few months later, she showed up again with a second fall. Now, as we can see with that image, if it goes through, that she's got a severe deformity with displacement of her subtalar joint, and this is completely unstable at this time. So what we're going to discuss today, though, is basically some of these overview components. We're going to look at some basic fall facts, some of the politics that are going on involving fall prevention and how it's important and a priority with the whole ACO model and Quality Care Act. It's also going to look at the falls assessment, particularly today. What can we as a profession do to assess our patients and indicate what their risk factors are? And finally, we're going to look at specific risk factors for our own profession. So, starting with basic fall facts, it's a leading cause of hospitalization in older patients, as we know. It's the primary cause of over 40% of admissions to hospitals and nursing homes. 10% of these falls result in a major injury, head trauma, fractures, and so on. 1% of all hip fractures and 5% of all other fractures are related to this in the elderly. And patients who have recurrent falls have nearly 4 times the odds of a fracture as a person that has a single fall. So that's why we're going to kind of focus on that component. Now, the accountable care organizations are making this a priority. In fact, we see it's one of the ACO numbers. We see specifically it's detailed here. And most importantly, we see that this is patients who are over the age of 65, who are at risk here, that are ambulatory, who are cognitively intact, but these are patients who have had 2 or more falls. Now, that's important because we'll go into that in a little bit more. So this is a real opportunity for us as a profession because we can go and we can involve in a public health issue very early on before it's really defined in a meaningful way. And so the question for us is, how do we really assess these patients? How do we look at them? And there's a lot of information on this, and that's what we'll cover. So what we want to be able to do is find something for any assessment that's going to be easy to implement, not a burden in terms of resource, in terms of time, in terms of complexity. We want something that's easy, straightforward, and reproducible. And it needs to be something that's meaningful. So, there we go. And so the score itself should, at the end of the day, generate some sort of likelihood, some sort of risk profile for us that we can hand to our patients and say, this is what is going on with you or your loved one. So the kind of the gold standard that we hear about is the Berg balance scale. It's 14 balance-related tasks. It takes about 20 minutes to do, but it's weak on dynamic activities. This is a study and a protocol that is more static in nature. It also is less useful in community dwellers. It was validated in kind of an invalid inpatient environment. And so it doesn't really translate well to those patients who are at the lower risk from our, or the highest risk from our perspective, because these are the patients that are in the community. They are not necessarily being monitored on a regular basis. And in fact, there is a recent study in 2003 that showed that it really didn't have a great correlation in predicting falls. So even though you'll hear about this a lot, you'll particularly hear about this from hospital administrators and from physical therapists, it really doesn't hold a lot of water. So, like I said, there's a lot of tools out there. That one's kind of the gold standard, but there's many ones that have tried to compensate, but they all have flops, faults to them. So they were developed incorrectly. They didn't validate appropriately. They're too time-consuming. A 45-minute test is not going to work for any of us. Too much resource dependence, or it was validating the wrong kind of population. most of these things will focus on a single fall issue, falls versus non-fallers. But the problem is any of us can have a fall. And so that's not really indicative of a physiological risk factor that's going to make you more prone or identify you as high risk. So that's why we saw that issue before within the ACO model. They were asking for something that's for multiple falls because that indicates that there's a more sensitive issue going on. So here's an example of an assessment tool that I find that has been very useful for our system, and we've used it with our patients, and it's something that is actually well-developed, very well-tested, and is extremely easy to use. So this is, we'll go through kind of development and validation for this process here. So they looked at the instrument development, they validated it, they did a test retest, and then they also checked with physicians to see how clinically feasible this is. So they took prospectively collected data, pooled it all together from three fall risk studies in community-dwelling individuals. They excluded anyone that was blind, someone that was cognitively impaired, and these patients were basically monitored for falls over a monthly basis for 12 months continuously, rating things as a single fall, multiple falls, and so on. Mean age 75, and 20% of these were men. Now, they asked these patients, did you have one or more falls in the past year? Are you taking four or more medications? Are any of these psychotropic? They looked at their sensation. They looked at peripheral sensation. They looked at some functional scores in terms of strength, reaction time, and balance as well. And they specifically identified ones that had high value. So this history is something that you can just implement on your own. You can just put this in right on your intake form at your clinic. You can just have them do this. It takes them just a second to do. The next is looking at that visual component, your physical exam. That's the biggest addition to our practice. The rest of this stuff, we already do. The functional component, that's going to take a little training, but your staff can learn it in no time, really and truly. So this is the initial instrument development we saw here. So they went through and they looked at sensitivity and specificity. They looked at the ROC curve for this to see how reliable these things were. And what we found was that total 59% of the patients had no falls at all, 21% of the patients reported only one fall, and 20% reported two or more falls during that time period. Now, what they found was that the relative risk was statistically significant for a number of these factors individually, but that statistical significance increased when you put them all together. The high sensitivity of all of them was the question, falls in the past year, have you had one or more falls in the past year? Based on that, you could predict with pretty good reasonableness the ability to determine who is going to have a fall in the subsequent 12 months. They did an external validation of about 350 patients in a second group of community dwellers. And what they found was it was almost exactly in line. Now you see that the falls rate dropped a little bit. You see that it was 51% had no falls, before it was 59%. 27% had one fall, and 22% reported two or more falls. So I'll go back and show you again. Pretty close in terms of those outcomes. But again, when they went through and they looked at the ROC, they looked at the sensitivity and specificity, and they looked at all these relatives of risk, again, they found the same kind of relationships. Everything was coming out with a high relative risk for previous fall history, total medications, psychotropic medications, and so on. And when you put all these things together, it increased their accuracy considerably. So this is the thing that was generated. This was the form that they were using. And at the bottom here, you can see that they actually included a probability, a likelihood, telling us exactly what the patient was at risk for. So they went ahead and, based on their model, they had predicted that patients who had a score of 1 to 0 we're going to have a 7% predicted falls. 2 to 3 points was going to get 13%. 4 to 5 points, 27% a risk of falls. And 6 or more points, 49% risk of falls. What they found was pretty doggone impressive. On this scale, they were able to predict within 3% the patients having the ability of having an actual multiple fall risk. And so this is something that's got fairly robust results. They then did a test retest just to see if there was a difference on the information. So they waited 2 weeks, retested the patients through the same thing with different assessors to see what happened and if the patients had the same profile and if that matched up. And again, they did 30 patients. They did this. It was 80, was the mean age, 33% men. And again, this is what they ended up having as a result. So excellent correlation on three of these factors, moderate on the remaining two. So very good, actually. They asked clinical feasibility components. They had 32 providers go through who were given all the supplies and the training for this. They applied this out of an average of 9 patients, but an average much higher than that, a total number much higher than that. And 72% of these providers said it took them less than 10 minutes to do. 88% of them rated it as a useful or very useful tool, and 94% of them said they would integrate this into their practice. So using this screen system, it's a free system. You can just get it through that publication. It's a multifactorial assessment. It has a 72% accuracy, detecting a multiple fall risk over a 12-month period. It's got moderate to excellent reliability, very resource minimal, and it takes less than 10 minutes to do typically. And it comes up with clinical recommendations as well. But how do we do it? Well, this is we're going to go through that very briefly here. So basically, has a patient had one or more falls in the past 12 months? Yes, give them a point. Does a patient take more, four or more medications, excluding vitamins and supplements, per day? Give them a point. Does a patient take any psychotropic meds? Yes, give them a point. Have them go ahead and do this visual acuity exam. All you have to do is you can just get one of these standard diagrams. You're going to have them stand 9 feet away, look at the 10-meter line, and if they can read it, then they're fine. If not, they get a point. Tactile sensation, all that happens is the patient will have 2 touches to lateral malleolus on both sides. If they can't feel either one of those touches, they get a point. The near tandem test. Now, this is something that's a little bit more involved, but the patient's going to be assessed for a balance assessment for that lateral stability, looking for that postural sway that occurs. The patient's going to stand barefoot with their eyes closed, feet are in parallel, left foot in front, and then with a certain distance here. And if the patient can't hold this with eyes closed for 10 seconds, then they get a point. The alternate step, this is that coordination component looking at the patient's ability to manage speed and manage other tasks. So that's part of that dynamic component we're looking for. With a set step in place, and they'll alternate those reps several times. Now, I recommend that if you're doing this, this is something you want to have your staff ready to assist someone just in case they do have a problem with a fall. If it takes them more than 10 seconds to do this, then you go ahead and you give them a point again. Sit to stand. Again, you're going to use a standard-sized chair. The patient's going to have their hands folded, arms folded, rather, and you're going to have your staff nearby just in case. They're going to go up and down 5 times as quickly as possible, and if it takes them more than 12 seconds, then they get 1 point. So, unfortunately, I know that that's all kind of very generic. I mean, how can we apply this more than just a scale for assessing our patients? Because it's not just, can you run this maze for us? We want to be able to have the patients actually have more information. We want to be able to see if there's a dynamic change or risk factors that they can alter that will make them better. So we'll look at some risk, podiatric risk factors, shoe gear inspection, and some exercises we can recommend for these patients. So as we know, there's studies that have shown that there's an increase with foot pain. There's a 4 times increase in fall risk for these patients. Serious foot problems, so biomechanical issues such as a bunion deformity, toe deformities, wounds, things that will cause them to have instability, has a higher risk of falls in patients over the age of 75. Patients that are over 70 also have a double the fall risk with bunions, and patients who are 65 or older with any kind of foot pain have an increased fall risk. Now, Mintz had a study that looked at this prospectively. They looked at 176 patients, mean age of 80, a third of them men, and assessed them for fall risk considering their physiologic profile as well as certain physiologic podiatric risk factors such as range of motion, which we all look at on a regular basis, what the grip strength of the digits was, tactile sensation, as well as deformity presence, foot posture, and the presence or absence of foot pain at baseline. What they found was that patients that had 12%, fallers had a 12% less ankle joint dorsiflexion on average. We know that Aquinas is a big driver of deformity and many conditions in the foot, and why wouldn't it have an impact on a patient's ability to avoid a fall. Fallers also had a increased risk when we're talking about having foot pain on a regular basis. These are patients that report they had foot pain on a daily basis, and fallers had an 18% prevalence of this. There's another study that came out by Mickle that looked at this toe weakness component. So we all talk to our patients about, you know, hammer toe deformities and why they're important to us. Well, this is an award-winning study that I really do recommend that you take a look at if you get a chance. It was a prospective trial, 312 elderly patients, and they assessed these patients for fall risk considering the presence of certain forefoot deformities. They looked at bunions and hammer toes. They looked at that grip strength, and then they used a force plate to determine what would happen if you had weakness in the hallux and the digits, or just the digits alone. And the results were 35% of the subjects fell one time during that 12-month period, and 33% of those ended up falling two or more times. That's 12% of the total cohort. So 55% of these ended up with an injury, 5% required hospitalization, 30% required some sort of medical treatment seen by some sort of physician or care provider. These fallers had less grip strength for all the digits, hallux and the lesser digits. Fallers were more likely to have a severe bunion deformity because of that instability in the first ray. And finally, patients were also more likely to have a lesser digital deformity, even in isolation. In terms of footwear risk, we can thank Dr. Menz for and Dr. Manat for a lot of these studies, but basically, we want to look at what are good recommendations in shoes. If we look at kind of what our patients wear around the house, a lot of more of those slippers that have no kind of heel counter on them, and it's just a huge risk. And so wearing barefoot or being socked increases the risk by 11 times as compared to wearing something that's got a stiffer sole, something that encompasses the heel, and including those things that have some sort of lace to them. 33% of hospitalized patients with induced hip fractures were wearing slippers at the time of the fall. And poor-fitting shoes contribute to 51% of falls in those hospitals. 72% of rehab patients wore ill-fitting shoes in this Manat study. 90% were either too wide, too long, because it's easier to get in and out of the shoe. That's what they care about, because it's too hard to get down, bend over, get their shoes on. And so we need to come up with a solution on that, obviously. But they need to understand that that's increasing the risk for that fall. 53% of these geriatric patients are wearing an appropriate shoe, the definition of which is kind of fuzzy. And then 128 residents of one geriatric unit, they found 28% were wearing inadequately fixed shoes, so not laced up shoes, something that caused those shoes to slip around. 25% wore shoes with an elevated heel, which I don't know how any of them are wearing high heels at this point, but 11% wore shoes that were well beyond repair. You get a lot of those patients who are basically they're financially strapped, and they don't want to go out and buy a new pair of shoes just to wear around the house. They think that's a ridiculous thing, but you got to educate them on this. You're at a higher risk if you don't make the right choices here. So getting back to that high heel component, so this is a lot of this stuff from Menz and Manat, and we see that the heel height of 2.5 centimeters or more than doubles the odds risk as compared to athletic or canvas shoes because it shifts that center of mass forward, and these patients don't have that compensatory mechanism to sway back and keep themselves under control. It increases that forefoot loading, which causes increased pressure, also associated with that increased pain. In fact, that may be the thing that's associated with those deformities we saw in the other studies. Alters the gait, obviously, as we all know. And over time, it causes a change in the muscle activity. The peroneus longus is being forced to stabilize for a longer period of time. This causes it to weaken, and this makes it fatigue easier. And so they don't have that limiting, stopping motion that the peroneus longus will normally offer us. And this, of course, causes additionally decreased gastroc activity. Even though it's in a contracted position, it weakens over time because it doesn't have that ability to have that excursion, and so it loses strength even though it's already contracted. So not a good thing. Finally, you look at the cushioning, the hardness of the types of shoes that are out there, and we see that these make some sort of difference, but it's not clear. The harder the shoe, those shoes will give them feedback. They can feel where the feet are in space a little bit more versus walking around in pillows as they all like to do, the Uggs and things like that. That additional midfoot instability, that midsole instability, requires that they have to use the subtalar joint and metatarsal joint more to stabilize themselves, so it's harder on them. Collar height, obviously, if you have something that encompasses the ankle, you're going to have something that's going to be more stable. It's going to provide any kind of a rigidity that is necessary for someone that might have a history of ankle sprains or ligamentous laxities over time. So does podiatry help reduce these fall risks? So I know that most of you probably read this study at this point, but I'm going to reiterate it anyway. It's an RCT of 305 community-dwelling individuals with increased fall risk. Their intervention was foot orthoses. It was a prefabricated thermofoam with offloading for high pressure points, calluses, and so on. Patients were given advice and provisions of footwear, and they were given a voucher for safe shoes. They were given an exercise program that was designed for this specifically, 30 minutes, 3 times a week for 6 months, and a falls prevention education program. Obviously, this is done in Australia because they have a very robust system for falls prevention, and I think that they're kind of leading the way on that at this time. Their result was a 36% reduction in falls, which is pretty impressive. So their primary intervention details, basically 66% of the patients completed this exercise program that they were doing here. 52% completed it, at least 75% of those subjects, those sessions. So those are the people that got what we would deem as adequate therapy or adequate exposure to therapy. The orthotics, 33% of the intervention group versus 30% of the controls had a difference in their falls. 103 patients were actually issued orthotics. Now, most of these patients say they wore their orthotics most of the time. How do we define that? How is that really accurately captured? Unfortunately, we have to rely on the data and say that it was done correctly, but we don't know what our patients really do. We don't know what they really are doing at home or what they consider being appropriate. So that's one part, one of the weaknesses with this component. And finally, the shoe gear, only a third of these patients presented with inappropriate shoes. The initial recruiting site was a podiatry clinic, so the odds are is that these patients are coming in and already receiving baseline education and care before they come and see us. So these are people who don't necessarily have the same kind of cross-section of their poor shoe selection we'd see in most of our patients, at least initially. And only 17% of these patients purchased new shoes. Now, their secondary outcomes were strengthened ankle joint eversion, was one of them. They looked at this, and this was substantially improved because of these exercises. Range of motion was statistically significantly improved for inversion and eversion, ankle joint flexion with and without the knee extended. Balance was found to be improved, and functional ability to perform these two functional tests that we already mentioned before also improved as a result. So it's a nice link in that way. These are the exercises that they are recommending for these people. Again, they're doing these 3 times a week, 30 minutes, and it was for 6 months. If you can get your patients to do these things on a regular basis, it makes a huge difference, obviously. I will tell my patients on a regular basis I want them doing these kinds of exercises. And I know my residents look at me with cross eyes and say, why are we having them do toe exercises? Well, I'll tell you why. It's because these guys have gone through and they've actually done these studies. They've had these patients try to perform specific tasks that target the intrinsic muscles, that target all this information for the patient so that they'll actually do them. And that helps them to be more functional. Does it get rid of their hammer toes? Absolutely not. I'm not suggesting that it does that. And they weren't either. But it does help these patients in terms of having awareness with proprioception, digital strength, and it helps not to destabilize the MTP, and so they can go through normal range of motion here. More exercises. I particularly like the marble one myself. But, so this gets us back to the ACO metric once again. So fall screening is this quality performance measure. It is something that the government cares about, therefore something your hospital or your IPA cares about, therefore something you will care about at some point. So when it comes down to this, you want to focus on these things. You want to make sure that you're staying on top of these things. You can perform a lot of these things very easily. Just train your staff in the beginning. Just ask about the patients. Did you fall last year? Have you had any fall, more than one fall in the past year? Great. Talk about how the fall occurred. Were you outside? Was it something where it was involved with ice? Were there children around or pets around? Something that interfered with normal ambulation? Perform your fall assessment. Like I said, this thing can take you 10 minutes to do. once you streamline the process. And if someone comes in with a high-risk profile, you can go ahead and you can make recommendations and you can make an impact for them. So here are the questions once again. Have you had those one or more falls? Is there any? Are you taking four or more medications? Are any of them a psychotropic? Look at their vision with that chart, check their peripheral sensation, and do these three functional tests. This will give you that probability of falling. I mean, just with those first three questions of have you fallen in the past year, medication, and a psychotropic, if they hit all three of those, they have a 13% risk right there. You're giving the patient information on the risk on multiple falls. So you have risk stratification, and it's something that's useful for your patients. When it comes to the deformities, make sure you're documenting these things. Does the patient have foot pain? Do they have hallux valgus? Do they have reduced grip strength? Digital deformities, again, grip strength. Do they have equinus, or do they have a foot type that makes them more prone to falls? A cavus deformity with a lateral ankle instability. So now that you've got your score and you've gone through all this and you've documented everything like you're supposed to, you need to actually put this in your note. You want to get credit for it. So this is the number you're going to use for this, V1588, personal history of fall. Those are the standards right there. That's not a primary diagnosis. It's a secondary diagnosis. So your primary diagnosis will be one of these other things. It can be the bunion, V, and then you do a 735. Then you put in the V15.88. Communicates that there's a risk fall assessment in here as well. All these things can work with it. You can theoretically do these CPT codes as well for being able to help your patients for doing the exercises, going over these things with them. Honestly, I don't know if you can actually get paid on these things. I think you have to be a physical therapist or in a certified resource center for this. But you can try, and at least you can have something given to you for your effort, because you do want to get these patients to do these things. And so if you have some sort of reward, you're more likely to go and do this. Look at those shoe gear characteristics. You want to avoid anything that's got a heel height of 4.5 centimeters or more. 2.5 can also be used, but 4.5 centimeters or more is really bad. Has to be a heel counter that doesn't compress more than 45 degrees. If it's so soft, it won't withstand heel pressure, and patients will walk right through it. Smooth soles increase your risk because of the fact that they can slip on the different surfaces. My shoes are a good example. And finally, a heel counter that's 20% or more wider than the heel. It's not gripping the heel. It's doing absolutely nothing. So I recommend those things. Now, what about my friend Etta? Now, she reported that she had a prior fall in the past 12 months, so she gets 1 point. She does definitely take more than four medications, so she gets a point. No psychotropic, so she's completely there. She just falls. And she passed her visual assessment, so no point there. But she only felt one-third of those monofilaments on the right leg, 1 point. Her near tandem test was more than 10 seconds, so that was good for her. Alternate step test took her more than 10 seconds, so that's 1 point. Sit to stand took her almost 60 seconds, so another point. So her score is 5. So her multiple risk factor profile for the year is 27% in the next 12 months. I give her that information. I can do something about it, and I can educate her. Now, in summary, fall prevention is something we can all be involved with. We've got a team over here that's dedicating themselves to it off its shoal, so I'm glad to hear that. Recurrent falls are more likely to be more indicative of an actual physiologic problem versus a single fall, so be more acute, in tune for those patients who have that issue. That risk stratification can be meaningful, can be quick, and can be useful. And look for those deformities we already look for, bunions, hammer toes, all those things. Add to instability, indicate some sort of muscle imbalance, indicate something that's going on at the physiologic level that puts them at a higher risk. And finally, these podiatric interventions can reduce these patients' falls in a meaningful way. Thank you.